Hi, Brian.
Hey, Megan, how are you?
I'm doing okay. I'm a little sick, as usual.
The chronically ill Megan McArdle. Sorry.
Yes. Unfortunately, I'm living with the germiest person on the planet, so every time he gets sick, I get sick.
You just told that to millions of Blogging Heads viewers.
It's not a secret. He gets like every cold that goes around, but I get like bronchitis and ear infections and sinus infections.
You know how Matt and Ezra and so forth, they got that food blog. You guys should have an illness hypochondria
blog.
Yeah, germ blog. Sure, whatever you want to call it. Talk about you know the various different symptoms you have from day to day. You know. With pictures, just like they have pictures of their finished food, you guys can have pictures of phlegm or something.
Well, you know, given that everyone in our circle of friends gets all the same diseases, I actually think it should be a group blog.
Oh, God. That quote, what you just said right now, that's going to appear on Gawker.
Just colds.
Yeah.
Not other social diseases.
Not other stuff.
Not as far as I know, anyway.
Yeah, my immune system, it should be said, is superhuman, and so I rarely get sick, but you know, just bragging.
Yeah, you just it's like a rich person just fanning themselves with $100 bills.
You get the money, and so, I get the good immune system. So yes, we're talking about the stimulus first.
We should introduce ourselves.
Oh,
I'm
right.
Megan McArdle. I write and blog for The Atlantic.
And I'm Brian Boydler. I write and blog for my eponymous site, and for this week I'm blogging for Matt Iglesias at Think Progress.
So we're going to start with the stimulus package. Actually had some ways of framing this that you wanted to talk about, so go ahead.
Well, okay. I guess the reason I wanted to use this as a jumping-off point for us is because maybe before it was totally clear where John Boehner stood on the stimulus, you had a post up talking about how he was acting as the sort of principled opposition to the Democrats' bailout package. It had basically been a Democratic show, and he was opposing it. And I didn't see things that way. I sort of thought John Boehner had decided to disagree with the Democratic proposal, no matter what it was, and then he'd sort of put a clarion call out for anybody who worked vaguely in economics to come and tell him and his caucus why. And Mitt Romney showed up, and maybe a handful of other people, but that was really it. And there was the House Republicans ultimately released an alternative package, and it was a joke. And it wasn't just a joke to liberals; it was a joke to everybody. But that doesn't mean that there isn't, in theory, an alternate, you know, hypothetical alternative to the stimulus package that libertarians would approve of or like better. And I thought maybe you could sort of outline for people like me who don't really follow libertarian economics as closely as we should what that might look like, and maybe we can figure out or talk about where hybridization might come from, who in the Senate might prove to have ideas that become amendments that, you know, make the stimulus package something libertarians don't have to totally hold their noses at.
Wow, that's a big job. So
okay, yeah.
I will start off by saying that there's a weird belief among most liberals,
mm-hmm,
that like there is no serious academic opposition to this package, and that it's just a bunch of Republican cranks.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who are opposed are not Republican cranks. There are some people who are making crankish arguments,
right.
But there is principled opposition to the stimulus. And the fact that the Democrats have been able to frame it as if there are no economists who disagree with this is pretty amazing. And in fact, you know, there was a blog that did a count last week, and he looked at actual macroeconomists as opposed to trade economists and historians like Brad DeLong, trade economists like Paul Krugman, and so forth. And most of them are against the stimulus. Now, that list was not necessarily comprehensive. It was, it was certainly, and a lot of the people hadn't spoken out. But there were, you know, there's a perception that just isn't true, that there's no real reason to be opposed to this. And I think that, like, just to dissect it a little, I did this on my blog, but, you know, there's a couple questions about the stimulus. First of all, will it work? And, you know, also, what do you mean by work when you say it'll work? If you're asking, can we raise measured GDP? Yes, this is a trivial thing. We can borrow a lot of money and spend it, and that will show up as an increase in measured GDP. But we could get the same effect by carpet bombing people's houses, because they would have to rebuild or, you know, go buy a house somewhere, and that would show up as economic activity. So the first question is, what are we actually trying to do? And there's two things that you can do that I think are reasonable to define as working.
Mm-hmm.
One is to say that we're just going to close the output gap.
Sure.
The economy is producing below its capacity. I'm a little skeptical of that, and most center-right and onward people are skeptical of that, because there are better ways to target unemployment. You don't build a bridge that you don't need because you have unemployed construction workers. You give the construction workers unemployment benefits. Maybe you help them retrain for another job. There are a lot of other better ways to target it than just keeping building stupid bridges. And Japan is a really good example of this. They have a lot of really stupid infrastructure projects that are just rotting. And they would be better off if they just hadn't spent the money at all.
Well, sure. But, I think one of the things that I think has... I don't know what the right word is. It has some liberals troubled is that maybe they think that the stimulus is too small, and the response from the administration is that we don't want to start building a bunch of projects that were conceived just because the funds were going to be there. And so, a lot of the ideas in the stimulus, whether it's the grid or construction projects, they were, you know, shovel ready. They were projects that there has been demand for but no money for a while, and they're sitting around ready to go. I don't know the bill thoroughly enough to say one way or another which of the projects in there looks to you like it might be the sort of let's build a bunch of bridges to nowhere in the states of Republican senators so that they'll get aboard on a cloture vote or whatever, but possibly there's some, and I'm open to hearing from you what those are and what they should be scrapping.
Well, another way to frame those projects, right, mm-hmm. is projects that the states wanted to build, but they decided they weren't worth paying for. They weren't worth raising taxes for. So now we're going to borrow the money and build them instead. And they're willing to do them with federal money. And I'm willing to do many things with free money that I wouldn't do with my own money.
Well, the states have to keep their budgets balanced, and there are politics in the states that prevent states that would love to, but just politically can't, you know.
Right, but here's the thing, right, is that what's happening with this stimulus package, with some of the spending, not all of it, mm-hmm. I think transfer payments are sort of a no-brainer. Obviously, I think unemployment benefits should be doubled, mm-hmm. And I think they should be extended.
Mm-hmm.
Welfare payments, housing assistance, that sort of thing. Those things are automatic fiscal stabilizers, and they're a good idea in a recession. We should do more of that than we are because we're having an unusually deep recession. I think we should try things like relocation assistance for people who are, say, stuck in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
But what's happening with the components of... Right, there's an unspoken subtext to the way that liberals blog about this, which is that they assume that the projects that are getting done are worthy. And right, like once you make that assumption, great. But they're pushing it through as stimulus because they don't want to have a debate over whether these projects are worthy. Right, these things, if they are worthy, should not be wrapped up in the stimulus package. Things like providing COBRA benefits for every worker over the age of 55 until they're ready for Medicare, and the federal government paying 65% of that cost, that's a huge new spending program. It's going to be almost impossible to cut back once you've done it. Right?
Sure.
These are the kinds of things, and it is getting no public debate because it's stimulus. This is not stimulus. This is in no way stimulus. These are things. So that's part of the problem.
Yeah, I don't know what the multiplier effect for keeping people on COBRA is, but I've got to assume that there's at least some stimulative benefit to, you know, not having a bunch of people getting into old age who are getting sick have to cover their own medical expenses. Instead, they pay for, you know, COBRA, which isn't super cheap or anything, but at least that way they don't have to pay for their chemotherapy and they can go spend that money.
Okay, but you see, like, you've switched from a stimulus argument to a welfare argument.
Well, just the status quo might be, you know, anti-stimulative. Not that necessarily you're going to get a huge multiplier, but that if you leave things as they are, you're just going to, you know, leave in place a status quo drain on the economy that you have because our, you know, healthcare system sucks, and that's just
It might be, but people in that age group utilize medical resources that are already pretty fully utilized from an employment perspective. Nurses are not, there's not a glut of nurses that we need to absorb. There's not a glut of doctors that we need to absorb. We have a glut of investment bankers, and none of them are very good at knee surgery.
Right. There we go. So COBRA is one. This provision is one thing that a libertarian economist might say, scrap that, either replace it with somebody else, something else, or don't replace it. But if you're talking about billions and millions of dollars going out to states and then letting those states use that money to pay for projects that they couldn't otherwise finance, aren't you going to the problem that the federal government is going to have to go through line by line, state by state, to evaluate for the states which projects of theirs are worthy and which aren't. How long is that going to take?
Let's dial back a minute, because we're still on the assumption that what we need to do is spend $1 trillion, and that we've got to figure out some way to do that. So the question that the skeptics are raising is there's these two theories of stimulus. I don't think that the output gap one is very convincing, because that's just the government will take up the slack in the economy. And I think that it doesn't end up working that way in practice. The economic theory often doesn't even sort of end up working that way in practice, because you get inflation and other problems. But what you get is government interference in structural areas that goes on long after the recession passed it. So there is a theory of stimulus that I think is worth doing if it's true, and that's the idea that we're in a liquidity trap. And, you know, the way to think about that is you get laid, you're worried about getting laid off, and so you and your spouse and your two beautiful children decide that you are not going to do anything except eat, go to work, and sleep. You're turning off the cable, you're doing every non-essential function that you used to do, every non-essential expense, you're just cutting so that you can save the money. Well, the problem is that you used to spend that money at restaurants and gas stations or movie theaters, and those people lose income. And so your saving is costing them income. They reduce their net saving. And the ultimate result is that they get laid off, and then you get laid off because you were selling them something, and that you can get stuck at a permanently lower level of output than you would otherwise be at.
Sure.
And so if you're in that position, the Keynesian theory is that the government, simply by stepping in and spending money on anything, can jolt the output back.
It's totally a fair. I mean, I suppose there are some people out there who are saying we should just be digging a bunch of ditches and filling them back in. But I mean, the Keynesian theory is not just spend money on anything, right? I mean,
actually, it is. Keynes said that it would be just as well if the government, if you couldn't find anything better to do, that the government should pay one group of people to dig ditches and another group of people to fill them up again. I'm just talking about what the economic theory is.
Okay, fair enough. The liberal consensus is not that we should be throwing money at hauling garbage dumps from one location to another and then back again. I mean, that's paying people to do it.
But they are spending the stimulus money as if that were the justification, right? What happens when you have these discussions is that it flips back and forth between these things are good, but I'm not going to prove that to you. I'm going to tell you that we need to spend a lot of money.
Okay.
We need to spend a lot of money. Do we really need to spend a lot of money? But these things are good. And, you have to pin down and prove on one grounds or the other that you are correct. Either these things are worth doing on their own accord, and they are justified by the economic return that they will generate or the utility return. But we shouldn't be giving people health care when the American public doesn't want to do it because we can get away with it. And that's a lot of what's going on with some of the stimulus spending.
Okay. If I'm willing to see the health care point, I want to get back to the state point, state spending. I am not an economist, and I form what opinions I have about the stimulus based on reading people whose opinions about this sort of thing I have trusted in the past. So that said, I think that, from what I know about the stimulus from its state spending measures, there are some good things about them and some things left out. And that's, that's where I am. But
let me just finish. I'm almost done with my walkthrough of Keynesian history. So the idea of that, basically the only, this works one of two ways if you're going to jolt us into a permanently higher level of output. The first is that people, that the projects actually produce an economic return. And the second is just that people think it will, and they're wrong, right? In their position as consumers, they overvalue the income they're getting, and it's not transparent, and they can't tell that eventually they're going to have to cover this in taxes plus interest on the debt that you borrowed. Although in this case, there's not. Now, I actually think that there's some validity to this. We're at a point where the government is borrowing for no money.
Right.
And people are basically begging Uncle Sam to take their money for free.
Right.
And we are definitely, I think when you talk, people talk about crowding out, I think that's normally a worry, and that's the worry that you know, Rubenomics was famously based on, is
sure.
that if the government is borrowing money, someone who wanted to borrow that money can't. Mm-hmm. But in this case, the government can borrow money for free because there's almost unlimited demand for government bonds, and there's almost no demand for any other kind of debt. And so the interesting thing is that it's almost as if we're doing, you know, we're doing interest rate arbitrage, right? Where the government is borrowing money to give us so that we can pay off our credit cards. And I think that's okay. But I think that you have to think about what are the costs down the road and minimizing those costs, because this debt is going to have to be rolled over. And when it comes due, and it needs to be rolled over, it almost certainly will not be trading at 0%. And if we keep racking up debt, it's going to be trading at a really high interest rate. And so the first question is this it? How do we know the stimulus is going to work? Because, in fact, the empirical evidence that stimulus can actually jolt us into a higher level of output is really thin. We've got basically, we've only got two examples
sure.
of a major industrial economy that's been in a situation like this in modern times where we had relatively good data. We have America in the 1930s, and we have, or you know, Western Europe and America in the 1930s, and we have Japan in the 1990s. And in neither of those cases do we actually see stimulus pulling things out of the economy. The only thing we really know how to do to end the Great Depression is have World War II. And, you know, maybe it's because we spent 50% of GDP. That's possible. We did. We spent, at one point, the government was spending close to 50% of GDP every year. But maybe it's also because we killed off 4% of our prime age male workforce. Maybe it's because people stopped being worried about their financial future and started worrying about dying, and that took their minds off the financial crisis long enough for sort of aggregate demand to regenerate itself. It's not clear.
Yeah, well, but this is sort of the thing. It's like there is you know, a theory about how to solve this problem, and it's had very little. You know, there's no stimulus laboratory, right? There's just, it can't be done that way. So let's say, you know, your worst nightmare for a stimulus is $1 trillion spent on ditch filling. And, you know, your ideal stimulus is one that we're sort of getting the contours of through this conversation. And the stimulus that we have is sort of has, you know, so somewhere between 25 and 75% of the elements that you'd like to see, and then somewhere between, you know, 75 and 25% stuff that you don't like. Is it worth a filibuster? I mean, is it worth, you know, is it, what would you like to see happen between now and, you know, the final vote in Congress to bring it into line? I mean, do you really want to see, call go out to governors and so forth to find out what they plan to spend the money on and telling them that you can't spend it on this or you can't spend it on that? Or do you want to see the addition of new things that you think work better and then just, you know, take the losses on stuff like COBRA that you seem to think won't do anything to help the economy or what? I mean, where do you go from here? Because it seems like if the other option is to just you know, dilly-dally or kill this bill, then you end up with, you know, that graph from the Romer Bernstein paper on the stimulus that has unemployment going up to double, you know, well into the double digits, right, and the economy not recovering for 3-4 years and at least, and you know, that sounds horrible to me, and maybe that's going to happen anyway. You know, there's like you said, there's just been very little in the way of testing this theory. But, you know, if the worst-case scenario is that we increase the debt by less than we increased it to, you know, go to war in Iraq, and...
But we actually won't have, right? In fact, this is going to cost more than Iraq and Afghanistan combined. This one stimulus package is now more expensive than Iraq and Afghanistan.
That, I don't think that's right, actually. But, I mean, we'll call it on the same order. But
I actually think that Iraq especially, is a good example of the problem here. And Brian Kaplan has this great syllogism that I think I've used on Blogging Heads TV a bunch of times. Something must be done. Two, this is something. Three, therefore this must be done.
But this is something that does have like a working theory behind it. I mean, another working theory is that we can cut capital gains taxes and hope for the best. But there's nothing in the literature that says that's going to do anything. So people who say that, I mean,
If you had asked me back in July, mm-hmm. whether we had a working theory of what caused the Great Depression and, to a lesser extent, what caused Japan, and could therefore prevent it, I would have said yes, and most economists would have said yes. Mm-hmm. Okay, the working theory of what had happened had to do with Milton Friedman's famous monetary history of the United States. Well, there, it turns out, some gaps in that. And Ben Bernanke's essays, you read these essays now and the gaps are suddenly glaringly obvious. There are just these points, very important points, like the consumption, the secular consumption decline in 1930, like the second banking crisis in 1932, where they just kind of say, well, we don't know what caused this, and then move on with their theory. And it turns out those are crucial questions. So having failed on the monetary side, everyone has now decided that therefore the Keynesian theory of stimulus must be right. It is not necessarily true that either is right.
Well, okay, I don't think that people are just like okay, on to the next one. I think and maybe these are like you said, unqualified economists on the center left and left who
no, they're not unqualified. They're just overconfident.
Sure,
and they're overconfident in a specific way. These are people like. Everyone who favors the stimulus really does break down very reflexively. And I should say, I'm a moderate skeptic. I think we're going to have it. I'm interested in it as a macroeconomic, and I'm agnostic as to whether it's going to work or not. I'm defending the skeptics because I think that they have a much better case than is getting heard. And so what's happening on the left is they feel triumphant. And there's also the thing, you saw this with Bush tax cuts, right, in 2001. With the stimulus from the Bush tax cuts. And, it was convenient to believe that what you already want to do is also going to jolt the economy out of recession. And it is, the human brain has very good mechanisms for underweighting evidence that would seem to contradict that.
But what the reasonable skeptics
are saying is simply that this is extremely costly. And the models, people are quoting these models about what the unemployment rate is going to be. And I think this is ludicrous. I don't think anyone has any idea what the unemployment rate is going to be with or without the stimulus. We just don't know. These situations are sui generis. And the level of confidence in predicting this is...
In the past when it has trended as it has for the past... however many quarters, I think what you're saying is that, like, who knows, maybe some awesome thing will happen and it'll rebound, but...
No, I'm just saying we could get stuck in depression and also have $1 trillion worth of debt, and that we should think carefully before we do something that we don't know is going to work.
And the argument is that the Krugmans and the Larry Summers is that they're not... I mean, I don't think that 8-10 months ago, when stimulus round one was under consideration, there was a bunch of people saying, let's just spend money on a bunch of projects that liberals also happen to think are good ideas to do anyway. There were criticisms of the stimulus that went forward, and it was too slow and too small, but the idea was, spending and monetary policy, and it wasn't just that, that didn't work, and so everyone was like, oh, shoot, what do we do now? Let's do... $1 trillion for infrastructure and whatever.
Let's do a thought experiment.
Okay.
Let's say that there was academic literature showing that tax cuts for the rich give you the most stimulative bang for your buck. How many of the economists now supporting a massive stimulus package would still be supporting?
I think that if the economic literature said that and it had said that for generations, the political alignments in this country would
look
so different.
But the economic literature tells you sort of a little bit about the relative virtues of spending into taxes, but it doesn't
tell you what stimulus does, a mathematical theory of output, right? It tells you that at times when unemployment is such and so and monetary policy has failed, so forth, you put a $1 trillion into projects that have a variety of multiplier effects, and on the flip side of that, you end up with higher GDP than you otherwise would have had and higher employment rates than you would have had. And that's what it's a mathematical idea, right? It's a theory. And it's the best one that we've got, right?
But this goes back to it's a mathematical identity. If you increase government spending and you borrow the money to do it, you will run up GDP. That doesn't tell you that you enhanced welfare. It just tells you that I increased a number that I'm measuring by increasing one of the components of that number.
Sure.
So, but here's the thing: is that we're not passing a little tiddly stimulus package. We're passing the biggest stimulus package ever, and it's enormous. And people are justifying the enormity of the spending on the grounds that this is going to jolt us out of a depression and into recession and recovery. And that theory, the theory that stimulus does that, depends on a whole lot of assumptions that we can't empirically validate because we just don't have enough examples.
Well, look, I mean, you yourself said that it wasn't labeled a stimulus, but you called World War II, the 50% of our GDP program that got us out of the Great Depression somehow, right? We paid.
But was it the 50% of GDP?
Huh?
Do we know? First of all, we can't borrow 50% of GDP now.
No, we can't. We can't now. But it's not as if on the like other side of World War II for the last 65 years we've been hampered and crippled. But there have been seamless or anything, but it didn't ruin the United States of America to fight that war, and so fast forward to 2009 when GDP is however many trillions of $10 trillion, it's not going to, if it fails and if it takes a long time for us to get out of this depression on our own, is the worry really that we can't, afford to do that? There isn't enough wealth in this country to down the line pay back that $1 trillion.
But World War II also, World War II, we emerged from World War II as the only industrial economy with a functioning industrial base. So saying that, it worked then, it'll work again, is really sketchy.
Well, that's not what that's not really what I'm saying. I'm just saying that do you think that
the way that the debt was funded in World War II is not a way the debt is going to be funded now. The kind of massive Liberty Bond drives, what are we going to have, recession bond drives? World War II just is different. It's different in so many ways. We took a bunch of the production that we had. Any excess production didn't matter because we blew it up on the battlefield.
Okay, fair enough. I guess what I'm asking is that even if it's half as effective as liberals hope it is.
If it's half as effective as liberals hope it is, it won't be effective.
Okay.
Either it jolts us or it doesn't. Either we hit a permanent, either we get back.
Sure.
On a trend line, or we don't. I'm not sure. How do you have? Again, if we were talking about was sort of tiding the economy over, that's a completely different question from the current justification for the spending.
I guess what I'm asking you is how does a good faith attempt to put $1 trillion towards fixing this problem that might not be successful, how does the problems that we'll face from having spent $1 trillion on the other side of this recession, how is that not worth it?
Well, if we get to a place, if you look at Japan, right? Mm-hmm. Japan never emerged from its doldrums. It just staggered along and has gone back into recession. If you look at that, well, they'd be better off if they didn't have 190% of GDP as debt, which is what the situation Japan's in from all of the massive amounts of government money that were poured into the economy trying to get it moving again.
Okay.
Now, there are lots of arguments about why it could be different here, but we could end up worse off. We could build projects that are terrible. I mean, there are infrastructure projects that can actively destroy value. You go to some place like Buffalo and see the subway that they installed, which destroyed their main street.
But in theory we could.
We don't know. The states have to run through this qualifying process. It's a free for all, right? They're dumping everything that they ever thought about doing into this in the hopes of getting federal money.
But I mean, they're not going to get everything they've ever hoped about doing. They're going to get what they can get going right away. They may have wet dreams about building new highway systems and speed trains, but they're not going to get that. So I guess, what would you like to see happen in the next week in the Senate then? Who do you think?
I would like to see the things that are not either tax cuts or extensions of transfer payments, direct cash transfer payments, hived off. And first of all, these things aren't even going to hit until 2010, 2011. It is not going to be the end of the world if we wait a month. And I would like to see those people justify those projects as projects, not as we have to spend a gargantuan amount of money on an untested theory. We're not doing it in the most low-cost way possible. First of all, there's good argument that what you want to do is get really quick shock spending. You want to put it all into the economy at once, and we're not doing that. The fact that we're doing these shovel-ready infrastructure projects is going to add 2 years to the stimulus because it takes time to get those things going. Shovel-ready is a very misleading term.
I think there's the flip side to that is that people who criticize the shovel-ready projects are assuming that there's nothing to put money into right off the bat. It's, you're not laying concrete or whatever on day one, but you're not paying people to do.
I mean, the things have to go back out to bid. First of all, you've got to put everything out to bid. You can't just spend the money because if you costed this thing 2 years ago, the pool of contractors will have changed, the price of materials will have changed, the price of labor will have changed. There will be all the, so you're going to have to put it out to bid.
Mm-hmm.
Then after you get it out to bid, it has to come back, go through the review process. They have to hit all of their legal hurdles to be certified and registered. Then, and only then, can you lay concrete or asphalt or what have you. And in between there's a lot of stuff you have to do to make sure that your supply chain doesn't get all screwed up. Because right now, contractors and all of their suppliers make heavy, heavy use of working capital because it can be 90 or 120 days between doing the work and getting paid for it.
So you want to nix all this?
Well, I don't want to nix it. I think infrastructure spending is good to do if it justifies itself. I do not think that it should be part of a stimulus package. It takes too long, and it is not. It takes too long, and it is too big an opportunity to do projects that won't justify themselves. That people will roll in because because it's free federal money for the states, and because we like shoving money out the door, because we're trying to spend money just to spend money.
Okay, so
if we're going to do that,
so we're getting closer,
spend
we're getting,
the money on things that are temporary.
Okay, so we're getting closer to the libertarian stimulus package. Hive off infrastructure spending, cut off a bunch of the healthcare spending. What about the clean energy stuff? Efficiency.
Same thing, that's infrastructure spending. This is all stuff that is not... It's not stimulus. It takes too long. Getting the project certified is going to take years. They're not going to be 2 million new clean energy jobs in 2 years, and you and I both know it. It just takes too long to spend government money that way. Transfer payments are a really, really efficient way to move money out the government door. The infrastructure is already there. We already have we already know who the people are. They will come to you. And it's relatively not non-distortionary. You don't end up with... We can double unemployment benefits now in a temporary way. We can extend them. We can increase aid for food stamps, housing assistance, relocation assistance, and we can end that when we have to. On the other hand, things like building a bridge, the bridge needs maintenance. The bridge is a commitment to keep tending that bridge. Paying people's COBRA, are you really going to cut people off?
But it also,
years?
I mean, but it also
years?
Is a,
that's
you know,
a commitment
it, it, it,
to
I
keep
mean, the government
doing
owns
it.
The bridge. It doesn't. It's not like the wealth disappears. It's and it provides. I mean, a well placed bridge can be hugely stimulative. You know,
but again, you're assuming that the bridge creates economic value and doesn't destroy it. Remember, money. There's a lot of broken windows fallacy going on here, and some of it's justified because, as I said, we're below output and the government's borrowing at zero interest. But money that we spend building a bridge, concrete and steel and everything else we put into a bridge, is not used somewhere else. We don't just get the bridge for free. We have to give up future resources in order to get that bridge now.
Okay, so if you're going to give $1 billion or $5 billion or $100 billion to California, you think giving that money to like BART to keep trains in service and keep their repair schedule up to date and not cut back on service, that would be
much actually I think that's
better.
I think
spent.
That's a fine it's a transfer payment.
Okay.
That's fine. Give them temporary transfer payments to keep stuff up.
But improving broadband access, that's junk. Toss it or keep it.
It's not junk.
I mean,
I don't know whether
it's
junk or not, and no one will tell me whether it's junk or not. They keep telling me, when I ask them if it's junk, they say we need the stimulus. When I ask if we need the stimulus, they say, you know, it's awesome. And they say that the improving broadband access is awesome. I want people to justify projects on the either on the grounds that they're awesome or on the grounds that they're a good stimulus. I do not want people to shift back and forth between those two arguments in order to avoid justifying things on their own merits.
Surely some of the stuff in the stimulus is both, right? That is stuff that can be done very quickly, and so is stimulus, and will be a down payment on infrastructure for a generation.
But it isn't. People are saying, you know, when Matt Iglesias is saying, look, it's awesome, two-thirds of the stimulus money will be spent in the next 18 months. Stimulus takes an average of 18 months to work its way through the economy. What you're saying is two-thirds of the money will have had an effect by 3 years from now. This is not quick. Infrastructure is not fast.
But,
they can be shovel-ready. They are not rapid.
But look, like
they're
not
the kind of thing
that
you should
be
doing
getting
stimulus.
Going. At a time when the stuff that you like will be nearing the end of its stimulative powers, right? So, you know, I think the argument is that this recession is going to require not just 18 months worth of stimulation, but 3-4 years. And I mean, isn't that why these projects are in there? Even if they take a couple years to get going, and even if they take a couple years from that point to really peak stimulus-wise.
Let's put it this way. If that's true, if we're still in dire need of stimulus in 3 years, we're in big trouble, and the stimulus didn't work. I mean, the fact is, if it doesn't jolt us to a higher level of output in, you know, fairly rapidly within World War II timeframe, which was 3 years, if we're still in that big trouble, then the stimulus failed.
I have in mind that paper that I mentioned already that Jared Bernstein and Christina Romer put out a few weeks back. And you take issue with the assumptions and the projections because who knows, right? But if that's fair, I think they said unemployment will peak somewhere between 2010 and 2011 and will be on its way back down around then.
Just when the stimulus is taking its effect, yes.
Or
two-thirds of it, because we'll still have
just when the stimulus parts of the infrastructure spending are taking effect. But in the meantime, there's, you know, unemployment benefits and, you know, whatever else that's going to start working much faster, right? So, I mean,
right.
it's not like you want to stop necessarily at, you know, when you think that unemployment has peaked. But I think if I'm remembering the graph correctly, that will be at the end of the, you know, the project's effectiveness, just, you know, as I mean, these are projections, right? Just as unemployment is like really starting to trend downward. And I mean, I'm not I'm not like the person to argue the merits of that paper with anybody, but you know, I don't see why we should dismiss out of hand the stimulative effect of infrastructure projects for a recession that might last many, many, many years, and especially when a lot of those projects are things that liberals particularly want to see.
Here are a couple reasons. Okay. I mean, first of all, I think that the way to deal with unemployment is not to do make work. So just for starters, I think the way to deal with unemployment is to palliate the pain of being unemployed, not to have the government hire them. You know, again, you can push up these figures any way you want. We can send everyone $3,000 and then tell them to go water their lawn and call that employment. So that's number one. But number two, I think that I really am very skeptical of these models. And I think that in uncertainty, we're in uncertainty. Anyone who says that they know where we're going to be in the next 3 years is trying to sell you something. They have no idea. No one has any idea.
Would you vote for it? Either the version that passed the House or the unamended version that's getting introduced in the Senate right now. Would either of these things be something that if you were a senator from a purple state, would you vote for it?
Well, okay, here's the question about this, mm-hmm. right? There's no upside to Republicans to voting for this. None. If they vote for it and it works, Obama gets the credit. If they vote for it and it doesn't work, they share the blame. And if they don't vote for it and it doesn't work, they get to say, "I didn't vote for the stimulus that didn't work."
But what about the 20 or so Republicans from maybe formerly red districts? They're in red districts. They were elected in red districts, but they went for Obama. You know, districts in Michigan and Indiana and stuff like that that were once 2-3% red. Now they're 2-3% blue. They have Republican congressmen still. All of them voted against it, and I mean, I think that there is a huge potential downside for them to be against a popular program that's being spearheaded by a popular president who's doing, at least a pony show for bipartisanship, more than George W. Bush ever did for anything.
Right. If it works really well and really obviously, if everything improves in the next 2 years. Then the Republicans, it will cost them. But it won't cost them that much because their upside is so small.
Right. I mean, I understand.
The best that they can do is not get punished.
I understand incentives for House Republicans. I'm not sure the same necessarily carries over to the Senate, particularly when you have, people like Snow and Collins who are, who hang on, by sheer momentum, but they're by no means promised re-election, and they, I feel like, really do have to get on board with a lot of Democratic ideas, or they'll be punished even if the stimulus fails.
Look, if it were me, I would probably vote for it because it's probably worth trying, but I would have severe reservations, and I would say, I think that the Democrats have structured this wrong. Since I can't get a good plan, I'm voting for this in the hope that the Democrats are right. And then if it turned out that they weren't right, I would say I always had reservations and the Democrats blocked a better plan. And I'm sorry that it didn't work out, and this is the Democrats' fault. I do think that the Democrats are going to end up having to take responsibility for this. They're not going to get to share the responsibility with Republicans. And so everyone had better hope that Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong and Christina Romer and so forth.
Right, and I think these are smart enough people to have gotten that political message at this point. And I think that if they thought that this was some sort of compromise stimulus that they thought maybe could get passed, and at this point we're like, well, we're not getting any bipartisan support anyway. I think if they really thought that, then you'd see an effort to turn it into the stimulus package of their dreams. But you haven't seen that.
I think they would have put tax cuts in anyway, because I think the fact is they just can't move money that quickly out the door.
That may be true.
And if they had not done tax cuts, it would have become incredibly obvious that this was just a gigantic pork fest and that this was all about Democratic spending priorities and nothing about stimulating the economy, because they just can't – there is nothing besides tax cuts and transfer payments that exits the federal government in under a year.
Well, Paul,
unless it's 9/11 spending. But that was really, really special.
Paul Krugman wanted to see something like, I forget what number he used, $1.4 trillion instead of $800 billion.
This is the thing that actually also gets me. Is everyone is setting themselves up to say, well, it wasn't big enough. And this is non-falsifiable.
You can always say
it should have been bigger.
And
as long as you pick a number that's bigger than the stimulus you get.
Nobel Prize winning economist, you know, from Princeton. I
just want people to make a prediction. If you're so confident in the value of your models, and you are so confident that you can project all this stuff in the future, then put your ass on the line and say, I predict that with Obama's stimulus, unemployment is going to be in this bounded range in 3 years. And no one's willing to do that. And that is a confession of how bad the models are.
No one is going to bet their
credibility on their model, but they want you to take their model.
But it's not Paul Krugman's model. It's how much money he thinks should be spent to get the stimulative effect that the theory he believes is true will have Paul Krugman said that he is in discussion has talked to Obama's economic team and so they know what he thinks and they're still at $825 billion. And the question I was getting to is, do you think there's a chance that the Obama team is keeping this smaller than liberal economists would like, so that, I mean, remember, he ran on an agenda of his own that included priority number one, energy and climate change policy, priority number two, healthcare, priority number three, education. I think he wanted his presidency to be about that, and about 3 months before the election, he realized we're going to have much bigger fish to fry before we can get to any of that. And to do any of those things, he's going to have Republican support. And I wonder if you think that part of the reason why he's doing this sort of discussion brunch thing with House Republicans and Senate Republicans is to keep them, you know, enough, you know, on his side that he can down the line get to programs that he wants to see, not that he has to, has to take on. And do you think that there's a risk that the Republicans in the Senate will say, okay, we'll vote for this, you know, with enough numbers to get it passed, we'll give you 75 votes or whatever, but now there's no more money for anything. You want $1 trillion, okay, but now you can't have any money for healthcare, and you can't have, if you're going to pass a climate change bill, you have to rebate all the money, or you have to, you know, something, but you can't put it into research or deployment or whatever. I mean,
if I were the Obama administration, I would be less worried about Republicans saying you can't have any more money than I would be about the debt market saying you can't have any more money. And there have been increasing fears expressed in the last 4 or 5 months about the creditworthiness of the American government and how guaranteed our AAA rating is. You know, right now, U.S. bonds are literally used in economics models as the risk-free rate.
Right.
They're the rate of return that you... If we lose that, our financing costs shoot up, and we'll have to refinance all of the debt we spend on the stimulus at really unattractive rates, because once debt ratings like that shoot up, they don't go down for a while. And so I don't think that don't get me wrong, I'm not accusing people of acting in bad faith. I think the Obama administration genuinely believes that this will work. What I'm saying is that I think that people are overconfident, and they're not willing to, and a sign of that overconfidence is that they're not willing to make actual predictions. So their model,
but, I
they,
mean,
they
but
issue
I'm
something
not,
saying,
you're not
we're going to go
I mean,
from,
like you said, you don't, you're,
yeah.
you're hesitant about this, but you don't, you,
which is why I would ultimately vote for it, because I would be willing to try. But I think that the skeptics have a really good point. I could be wrong. I was wrong about TARP, and I could be wrong, and this could be a really, really costly way of doing nothing or actively destroying value.
Where are the skeptics?
And
where are the skeptics that you talk about? And I know who you're talking about, generally speaking. And you're talking about a very different category of people than, say, you know, Mitt Romney, who showed up to boost for capital gains taxes. Where is this representation in...
I'm talking about economists.
But who speaks for them on Capitol Hill? Because I think the reason why I don't think liberals are framing anything anyway. I think there is, you know, you have Megan McArdle's and Tyler Cowen's out there making some worthwhile points about the stimulus, and nobody on the Hill is speaking for them. And so when liberals say there is no alternate plan, they mean, you know, written proposals that have circulation amongst, you know, any significant number of legislators. And I think that's
right,
true.
But do you think that the Republicans, do you think the Republicans aren't there because they don't want to be? I mean, they're not there because the Democrats aren't going to listen to
but
them.
They're not there because the Democrats don't.
But Barack Obama,
like, went out of his way to hear a bunch of bullshit from House Republicans about how to fix the stimulus, and he basically said no to all of their ideas, and they came out with this plan that, I think John Hankey called it, you know, embarrassing. And
the most terrifying thing that I have heard about this crisis so far was when Joe Biden said there is no reputable economist who's opposed to this plan. And that was a ludicrous statement. And the fact that he believed it indicated an insularity that I can't even imagine.
I don't know the quote that you're talking about, but I think that something that's approximately true is that there are no reputable economists who disagree with the idea that the government needs to outlay and invest a lot of money very soon, right? And
No, that's not true. In fact, there are reputable macroeconomists who basically believe in using the fiscal stabilizers and possibly in using tax cuts, but not in. I mean, there are people out there who have been talking about this. We had on Atlantic Business a really good video with three University of Chicago people, including Robert Lucas, who actually supports it, but. You know, it's just not true. Cato had a list of 200 economists who signed in opposition to the stimulus bill,
and
including three Nobel Prize winners. These are not cranks. These are not, and the Democratic idea that it's just a bunch of cranks who are out there and they're not trying to represent themselves. I agree with you that the House Republicans did a terrible job, and I think that in general the House Republicans, their grasp of economics is not sound. So don't get me wrong, I am not a fan of supply side economics. I'm ashamed, like I'm not even a Republican, and it embarrasses me that we have so many Republicans who still talk about this. And I voted for Barack Obama. I mean, or I would have if I'd registered to vote in time. But that's another like, I mean, on the other side, that is giving people belief that they don't have to listen to people who aren't supply-siders. And there are a lot of conservative economists who are not supply-siders.
But look, I think those people got
written out of the debate.
You can find in journals and on the blogosphere, you can find reputable economists on the left debating reputable economists like Tyler Cowen about this. And it's really interesting reading for amateurs like me. And then you look at Capitol Hill, and those liberal economists have real representation. Their views are considered and implemented into the proposals on the Hill. And on the right, everyone gets shut out except Grover Norquist. And so when Joe...
I think that's an exaggeration.
Sort of. And not a huge one. And not that there's no room to bring the stimulus as it is closer to something that you'd want to see, but that when Joe Biden says... no reputable economists disagree with it, he's exaggerating because he's Joe Biden, but he's also not, wildly distorting the picture of what, is actually happening on the legislative, turf, you know, like...
I think that the attachment of the Republican Party to supply-side economics is ridiculous. And I think that it is crippling the party. And I think that I think the Republican Party is in crisis right now, and that they need to go back.
You and John Shate need to have that dialogue where you guys, reconcile and talk about your hatred of supply side economics.
Those talks are starting to happen in the Republican Party. I don't know that they'll go anywhere.
It's a little too late.
I don't think they're. I don't think that this is the other thing, right? In 2004, we were talking about a permanent Republican majority. It is not impossible.
Okay. I thought you meant these talks are starting to happen. Like, you're going to get your Mitch McConnell's to stop listening to idiots and start listening. No, that's, I mean, that should happen, but it's not going to happen in time for the stimulus, right?
Right.
I mean, that's...
I think that the House Republicans might have done the right thing for the wrong reason,
mm-hmm.
Because they may be right. I'm not arrogant enough to think that my tentative support for the stimulus is guaranteed to be a better course than doing nothing. It could be better to do nothing. Sometimes it is. You know, we're both not big fans of the Patriot Act, and it would have been better to do nothing.
But doing nothing is in its own way doing something. And like you said, you don't have a whole lot of case examples a Keynesian response to a recession producing wonders right away. You don't have a response of doing nothing to a serious recession working wonders right away. And, you know...
But the don't just stand there, do something. I mean, this is something...
But don't just stand there,
do
nothing is a version of doing something. I mean...
Right, but it presumes that that is not the best alternative, right? You are presuming that there is some action the government can take, that this is just absolute bedrock truth. There is some action the government can take to make a depression not happen. And I think the empirical evidence for that is sketchy. They happen.
But the theoretical evidence for it is not, and that's why, you know, if there was,
all I'm saying is that in this much uncertainty, I'm willing to bet on the stimulus.
Me too.
But being
Hoorah.
Not willing to bet on the stimulus is not a ridiculous position, because in fact, they could be right. It could be that doing nothing is the best of a really crappy set of solutions. And we won't know until, and we will know in a couple of years. But what I would like to see is for the people who are strong proponents and not squishy like me, where I just throw up my hands and say, I don't know, try it.
Yeah.
The people who are really strong proponents and who are getting really enraged at anyone who disagrees with them, I think those people should be, if they have that much faith in their models, they should be willing to make predictions. They should be willing to say, okay, unemployment's going to be, I don't want you to give me like a 9.2, but a bounded range of where unemployment's going to be, a bounded range of where they think GDP is going to be in 2 years.
Well,
I'll
throw in my lot with Romer and Bernstein and just steal their numbers, and I'll lay it out on the line, and I'll predict that their projections are right.
We're going to be 9% plus
or minus. And if I'm wrong, I'll buy you a Coke with, you know, with my welfare check or my, you know, unemployment check, okay? You say you're squishy. There's an analogy here to an issue that's a little bit more near and dear to my heart, which is you're not a libertarian or conservative who doesn't think climate change is happening and happening because of what we do and is dangerous. But presumably you are skeptical that this or that approach to the crisis will work. So my guess, and I don't really know, is that you strongly favor taxing carbon over capping it and auctioning permits,
yep.
And that you worry that a cap and trade system wouldn't work. Would you get behind a cap and auction system if that's what the legislative process delivered us? Because probably that's what it will deliver us.
My issue with cap and trade is that you look at the European system, right? And the EU system is like those blues musicians who are having some trouble with their woman and always just about to get it together. I've been hearing for years that it's really, we've ironed out the problems. Now it's just about to really start reducing carbon, and it doesn't. And the problem with cap and trade
a fair description of what happened in Europe. They set their cap too low, and it was a mess, but... There's no reason to think that, you know, it's not going to work. It may not work for different reasons, but we'll see. The history of cap and trade programs in general is not so bad, you know. I mean, one of the reasons I support it is that there is
sulfur
actually
sulfur dioxide works really well.
Absolutely. Say, what would you say?
The sulfur dioxide permits have worked great.
Right, and there's some, you know, the people who designed that, I mean, you know, there's some institutional memory for designing a cap and trade system. It would be a much bigger one. It would create a much bigger bureaucracy than a carbon tax. But it has, you know, the added benefit of, you know, if it's designed well enough to, you know, to where the emissions match the caps, of ratcheting down carbon at a predictable rate, which is which is what the idea of behind abating the problems of climate change is to reduce carbon, not make it so that for years and years and years, wealthy companies burn as much as they ever did. It's just as the price of doing business, right? And then it takes, you know, you have to keep recalibrating your tax or whatever.
Look, in theory, cap and trade is equivalent to a tax. If all information is known, then you can either set the tax or you can set, if you know people's value of the carbon and the cost of the carbon, you can set either the tax.
But it's not equivalent because you don't know how much Texaco is willing to dish out.
In theory. We don't live in a world where all our information is known. So in that case, one is better than the other. And I think there are a couple issues with carbon trading. And I actually don't favor carbon tax either exactly. I favor source fuels tax because I think here are the issues. SO2 worked really well because we know where all the coal plants are. Mm-hmm. And they don't move around a lot. And they're right there where we can see them. And we can monitor their SO2 emissions. You know, it's a limited market. It didn't affect that many.
Sure, it's a much smaller scale.
It's not transparent to voters. Much smaller scale. So with carbon, first of all, if you don't do a source fuels tax, you're going to have trouble taxing transportation uses, right? Because you don't actually know how efficient these cars are and so forth. But second of all, going beyond that, if the only way that a cap and trade system is really going to work, in theory, is abatements. Is that people reduce the low-cost person to reduce their carbon reduces their carbon emissions. The problem with that is that the way that it's working, right, and the way that they're trying to bring China on board, which I agree is really important, is that there you have these projects that you go and you pay someone in the third world to shut down a polluting factory or whatever.
Sure.
And the issue with that is that auditing what's an actual, and this is what we've seen with all of these TerraPass and so forth, auditing is non-existent.
Sure.
It's impossible to figure out what the other state of the universe is in which this thing didn't exist. But if you don't do those abatements, it's politically impossible to get the thing passed.
The demand for carbon, the ground is shifting on this. You're right. It's still a real political consideration, but I can imagine a cap and trade system passing, that does not allow companies to buy offsets and count that towards their carbon reduction. I don't think that's impossible anymore. I'm willing to throw in my lot with Roman Bernstein, but I'm not willing to bet on that. But it's not like a crazy idea anymore, I don't think. At least that's not my sense.
I think that all of these things sound fine until you actually put a price on them and you realize that the price is really pretty transparent to the consumer. And right now, in the middle of a recession/depression, are they going to raise heating costs? Are they going to raise the cost of everything to the American consumer? I mean, you know, people are talking about, well, it's only 1% of GDP or it's only 3% of GDP. Right now, that's a lot of money.
Right. And, well, I mean, there's a question of what you do with the revenue. And I know Bob Corker, who nobody would have ever expected to be a friend of the environment, says he'd prefer a carbon tax, but he has said he would be on board with a cap and auction system with no offsets, with 100% of the revenue rebated to people. Presumably he wouldn't be a fan of the most progressive rebate imaginable, but maybe he would. That's something that progressives could get on board with. Maybe it's not ideal. I think Joe Rahm has argued, and I find his argument convincing, that you want to rebate maybe 60-70% of the revenue and dedicate the rest to deployment of proven technologies and to adaptation to the climate change problems that are already locked in, like researching tropical disease or producing tropical disease medications, and et cetera, et cetera. Maybe there's some common ground there, but it will be a huge piece of legislation. It will revolutionize the economy, just like perhaps the stimulus package will, and just like the stimulus package, it may not work. And so are you squishy on both sides? Would you support something vaguely like what I just outlined on the maybe not off chance, on the chance that it would
save mankind. It would depend on the details.
I'm happy to hear that despite, wanting to toss a bunch of sand up about the stimulus, that you would actually vote for it. And I think that if you were a senator, I would support you in that.
But see, this is the thing, is like, it's a perception that I'm tossing sand up, that I'm just criticizing it because
I'm teasing you, come on.
But this is how it gets treated. Like, Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong, I'm squishy on the stimulus and I'm sort of a supporter. And they attacked me for saying something really fairly trivial about, what the multiplier might be on this money.
I read that.
But, this is the thing, is I think there are actual questions, and I would prefer, rather than not, to see these actual questions about things like the cap-and-trade program settled. I think the audit problems are really hard. I think that I would vote for it if it weren't. It would depend on how badly I thought it was likely to be a public choice problem.
Right.
In that, how quickly is this going to be captured by gigantic power companies and used to beat their potential competition into the ground?
I think the political discussion will improve for people in your position once the people in your position are treated as legitimate interlocutors on Capitol Hill, and that is a problem with the Republican Party. And perhaps instead of arguing, with Paul Krugman and Brad DeLong about this and that, it's time for libertarian or center right or whatever economists to make a big push to have the opposition party in Congress listen to what you're saying. And, this would be an interesting discussion to have right before the next depression if the Republican Party wasn't operated by a bunch of charlatans and thieves.
Well, I'll close by saying I think the Republicans have the same party that the problem the Democrats had in the 80s, which is that where their reputable economists are, in some ways we're way to the right of the Republican Party. I shouldn't have included myself in that number, but in some ways they're way to the right of where the Republican Party is, and in some ways they're to the left of where the Republican Party is. But what the voters, what that base wants to hear is that there's some magic tax-cutting formula that doesn't involve any trade-offs, just the way what Democratic voters wanted to hear was that there was a magic spending formula that wasn't going to avoid any trade-offs. And I'm really afraid that that's the way that the Democrats are now heading. It's now fun to tell people that we have a lot of money we can spend and give you things. And when the bill comes due, there are going to be issues, but that's going to be down the road. And then there's a cycle to these things. Sure. And I don't know how it comes back. I don't know. I think the Republican Party needs to, and I hope the Democratic Party too, because this is the other thing, is that I think Biden should, because he's a Democrat doesn't mean he shouldn't know that there are people who are worried about the stimulus. I think the Democrats have a responsibility, in the same way that Republican senators had a responsibility to be more responsible about tax cuts than they were. I think the Democrats have a responsibility to at least be aware that there are legitimate arguments on the other side and understand the terms of the debate rather than surrounding them with people who tell them what they want to hear.
I don't think it's the Democrats' job to hear out people who they don't agree with ideologically, right?
Question. It will work or it won't. And yes, I think they have a responsibility, even if they would rather it were true that it works. I would rather it were true that if we privatize Social Security, everyone would instantly be magically better off. But look, I would not be doing the country a good job by shutting people out. They wouldn't say that to me.
Let me be fair. I said that wrong. I think that the Democrats' failure to hear out skeptics of the bailout on the right is arguable. I think the fact that Joe the Plumber is coming to Capitol Hill to sound off with Republicans about what opposition to the bailout should look like is disgusting. It's like embarrassing. And I think that the failure for there to be a dialogue amongst politicians about how to approach the stimulus rests in their camp and not with Democrats who have surrounded themselves by a handful of the most reputable economists in the world, you know?
I think that the Republican Party is, I'm not, you know, betraying any secrets here, right? The Republican Party is in deep, deep trouble right now. I also think, though, that I'm interested in how quickly the hypocrisy cycle is moving and how, you know, all of a sudden everyone who was for bipartisanship when the Republicans were in charge are suddenly realized that, no, you know, we got a mandate from the people and it's our job to govern without their help, and all the Republicans have switched positions and no one blinks.
You're talking about bloggers, though, because I think that the president's outreach has been, I think he's wasting his time, but I think also, you know, this is something that a lot of people who do what I do every day wouldn't have, you know, necessarily like wanted to see the dramatic overtures to Republicans to say, I may not listen, you know, or adopt anything that you suggest, but I'll listen.
I'm not criticizing. I like Barack Obama. I think he's doing the best he can according to what he thinks is true. I think that liberal economists are doing the best they can according to what they think is true, although I also think that just as conservative economists were overconfident in markets, they have become way overconfident in government. But, you know, I think that ultimately I'm just pleading kind of humility and process, because I was blindsided by this, and I think everyone was. I think that there's a narrative that like Paul Krugman predicted this, and he didn't. No one understood that this was coming because this is so massive and so weird. And so, you know, he predicted the housing bubble, but we all called the housing bubble. Everyone who was writing about economics called the housing bubble and said that it was going to be a big problem and that the wealth effect was going to cause consumer spending to contract. They just didn't predict it taking down the banking system with it. And so I think this has made me humble, and it's made me humble about really big narratives that were really common and widespread, that they were the dominant narrative of the profession, that all we've done is just done a 180 and say, oh, well, if this doesn't work, then that other thing, which the people who proposed the first thing don't like, must then therefore work. And I think that, you know, I think the Obama administration is doing a pretty good job so far. I think it's weird that none of his nominees seem to be able to like comply with basic.
Yeah, I was going to say we got to have a discussion about Geithner Dashlin. There's a new one today. What's her name?
For me, this isn't about like do I love Republicans and hate Democrats or love Democrats and hate Republicans. It's just about, I think there's a lot of empirical questions to be settled here, and we haven't done a very good job about actually talking about those questions. Instead, we've done a really good job. We have a lot of boosters saying, well, oh my gosh, here's some way that the stimulus could be even more awesome than I had originally thought. And then you have some skeptics who say silly things, not to name names, but that there are actual real empirical questions here, and I don't think that they're being well addressed. And that makes me sad, because I think that in fact on things like, you know, tax cuts, There were ways to address that didn't happen, and it wasn't a good debate. And I think that's just happening again. And I'm concerned that I just got a news flash. Daschle has withdrawn.
Whoa!
But you know, I'm more interested in the empirics of it, and I don't have any answers. I'm just asking questions because that's all I have right now. And I kind of wish more people were doing that. I guess would be my ultimate thing. But I would vote for the stimulus. And I would vote for the because in both cases, it's worth trying to do something that will avert a disaster, but I also think that it is worth trying really hard to do that in the least costly way possible, and I'm afraid that in both cases, we're failing at that second mission.
What would be your ceiling if Krugman got his way and it was a $1.4 trillion or whatever stimulus? Would that be enough to send you into the, no, I'd vote no on that?
It would depend on the composition. But I also think, at $1.4 trillion, I would really start worrying about sovereign debt problems, because we can't spend that kind of money indefinitely.
So,
it's
we're in territory that, like, I can't you know, comment on. I'm not a, I don't have fluency in these issues, really. I just sort of wanted, I envisioned this as a sort of like Socratic way to draw out a an alternate stimulus or something, and ways to make inroads towards that for people like you who'd like to see it changed. And I think we've succeeded in a way.
I hope. Anyway. Unfortunately, I don't really have... I have a broad band that I would accept things in because I am so uncertain about how this is all going to end up. But I guess we should... We've gone way over our time, and we should
yeah.
close this out. And I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about... talk more about the environment,
so many,
because you have a lot of
good stuff to say.
Yeah,
we were
going to
talk about the future of journalism and how we're both screwed.
We flashed ourselves
even though,
to the
even though your name is, even though your name is getting kicked around for a New York Times column or something crazy like that. My name is not, so I am screwed.
Well, the New York Times' name itself is getting kicked around as a possible bankruptcy candidate, so,
Who? Oh, yeah, sure. Okay, well, we'll have another dialogue about how we're both screwed, okay?
Bye-bye, Internet.
Until then, bye.